This is the Head Torch podcast. Welcome. Our mission, to create a mentally healthy culture at work. Keeping the conversations alive, our podcasts bring you great presenters and stimulating discussion on mental health and well-being in the workplace. Enjoy. Mike, yes, I believe you have brought some sort of object which you are going to share with us, which to tell us a little bit more about yourself. Ooh.
It's a crystal ball, which I have on my desk all the time, and I pick it up quite often and just hold it, especially if I'm at a session or listening, you know, keep my hands busy. And I use it as a kind of a meditative object, and I also use it to read the future, except I don't really read the future, I just see myself in it. And it's a reminder that whatever I'm seeing, I am seeing through a glass darkly. It kind of works on so many levels for me, this thing. And yeah, I can't recommend it highly enough. Get yourselves a crystal ball. They're just lovely things to have around. I also have a prism when I'm feeling more analytical. I can pick up this prism and split light, but generally it's the ball that I go for.
What did you say there? You see yourself through darkly or something, you said?
Well, you know, there's that line, I think it was T.S. Eliot. Was it T.S. Eliot? Anyway, we see the world through a glass darkly. You know, however clearly we think we're seeing things, however much we think we understand, we see it, you know, through our own distorted lenses. And it just reminds me of that, that when I'm feeling that I'm right and you're wrong, that's possible. But I'm seeing it through the glass darkly.
Fantastic. That's wonderful. Great. Well, thank you, Mike. So we're going to move on now to your presentation. What's going to happen is we're going to hear from Mike for roughly about 15 minutes. And then Nick Lander, our colleague, is going to put us into breakout spaces. And we'll be in groups of about four or five people max. And as somebody said to us, was it just yesterday, I think Angus said, oh, it's a bit like blind date. You've no idea who you're going to end up with. So Mike's going to give us a few questions for us to consider in those breakout rooms. And we'll have about 15 minutes there to discuss those. And then we'll come back into this main space, if you like, and then it'd be great for folk to share some of the insights, some of the discussion points that were raised in your groups. We may not have time to hear from every group, but a few people, if you'd like to share, that would be lovely. And then, of course, there'll be time for a bit of Q&A with Mike as well. So here we go.
Brilliant. Thanks, Amy. Yeah, that title, Works Mental, every time I read it, it sort of strikes me in many different ways. But a lot of my work is done in the English NHS, where in the year up to January 2020, pre-COVID, 40% of our nursing workforce had to take time off with stress-related issues. That went up to 55% if we looked at midwives. If 55% of our workforce were suffering from cuts, bruises, broken bones, I'm pretty sure that employer would be closed down. But somehow stress-related illness doesn't seem to register the same level of importance. And at the same time, NHS England, NHS Improvement, NHS Provider, CQC, all the powers that be had agreed that what we needed was more compassion. Compassionate leadership, compassionate care was going to be the answer. And I was very aware that I don't think I'd met anyone in 10 years of working in the English NHS who needed to be told to be compassionate, or maybe one or two. But the vast majority had compassion in spades. There was just no room for it at work, actually. And if it was shown, if it was exhibited, there was nowhere to process the emotional labour, the trauma that came with that caring. So it wasn't that people weren't compassionate. It wasn't that people didn't care. It was that the system and the structure had somehow made it difficult and damaging and dangerous to care. And I was really puzzling about this. You know, how do we develop leaders differently? How do we give them new leadership skills, new leadership frameworks, new leadership models? And then, of course, I was realizing it wasn't just the NHS. It was just about any part of the public service. And actually, it wasn't just the public service. It was just about any corner of society. And, you know, how do you build a mentally healthy workplace in a society that isn't mentally healthy? You know, if we look at it as sort of a series of nested Russian dolls, we may be pushing against the tide. So I started to look and think about where the root of this might be. And luckily, I bumped into quite early on in lockdown some people from further education who were very much driven by sort of post-humanist perspectives. So the world is more than human, and we need to care for things other than just humans. And we need to decenter the human a little bit, take less anthropomorphic ways of looking at the world. And they were also very interested in the ethics of care. Now, I couldn't believe, having been working in leadership at quite senior levels for sort of 10, 15 years in the NHS, that I'd never heard of this thing called the ethics of care. And if I'm honest, I hadn't really thought that much about ethics. You know, the moral reasoning that we bring to our day-to-day existence. Of course, I was aware that they were there. I knew roughly what they were, but they certainly weren't forefront. And I hadn't really explored in any great depth my own ethics, my own ethical framework. So when I bumped into this thing called the ethics of care, I got really quite enthused about it. And I started reading some stuff on ethics again. Now, I'm no ethicist, so I don't want you to be thinking that you're going to get, you know, any expertise from me on ethics. But I started digging around. And, you know, the history of ethics, I suppose there are two really almost ancient schools of ethics. There's the school of virtues. You know, we should be beautiful and we should be strong and we should be kind and we should be loving and we should cultivate those virtues. And if we cultivate the right virtues, we'll find ways of dealing with life. So sort of virtue-based ethics. And again, you know, in the pleas to be compassionate and be comparing, that's an example of virtue-based ethics being used to try and influence, manipulate human behavior. And then there was what they call, ethics is so lovely, they use so many complicated words, deontological ethics, which really means just the ethics of rules. You know, don't kill your neighbor. I think that was handed down on a tablet of stone somewhere. Don't covet your neighbor's ass. Do no harm is a lovely one from the medical world, which seems to be forgotten about, trivialized, and not really taken that seriously when we look at the sort of the damaging nature of so much of modern medicine. Do no harm. So, you know, a series of rules. If we just get the rules right, we follow the rules, you know, we will be behaving well in the world. We'll be good in the world. And again, ethics does seem to be stuck in this notion of we're either good or bad. And our ethical frameworks help us decide what is good action and what is bad action. And then there are the two new kids on the block. And, you know, there are more than four schools of ethics. I'm aware of that. But let's keep it simple. The new kids on the block, utilitarian ethics, which came out really, I suppose, from the sort of 17th century Enlightenment, where we suddenly realized that we could understand the world, we could predict the world, we could control the world, and in some ways we could control our own futures. Rationality, logic, reason, drive, determination, competitiveness. These utilitarian ethics, the work of people like Jeremy Bentham, started to give us a way of apparently controlling our world and actually taking domination over it in some ways, you know, and what I hear we're doing with vaccines at the moment, you know, the way that our vaccination programs have leapt forward means that apparently we can control viruses now. So that's all right. We don't need to do anything more substantial about caring than be able to develop a vaccine quickly. So the utilitarian ethic really for me can be summed up as using rationality to calculate how we do the greatest good for the greatest number, or how we maximize profit for the lowest cost. So using rationality to calculate these sorts of ideas, and then unleashing our plans on the world and expecting it to fall into place, expecting our plans to come to fruition. And of course, quite often they do. You know, utilitarian ethics has produced loads and loads of really tremendous results. The whole world of science is based on this kind of ethical framework, I would argue, primarily based on this kind of ethical framework. Through rationality, we can mold the world. It does really well when it's dealing with quantities. It does really well when it's dealing with things that can be measured and calculated. It struggles a bit with concepts that are more about form and are more contested, like beauty and love and care and compassion. These are things that don't necessarily fall easily to the world of utilitarian ethics. You will see equations for care, and you will see equations for trust. You will see people attempting to put these into mathematical frameworks. But these are things that are dynamic, that are non-binary, that are present in some contexts but not in others. We could argue that they're almost ineffable, that actually words cannot describe what these things really are in our lives. So utilitarian ethics kind of struggles a bit with a whole range of the qualities of humanity that I think make us human. And you could argue that it's extreme. Utilitarian ethics reduces humanity to a great calculating machine. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with Adam Curtis's work, but he's been talking about how the whole emergence of ecological thinking and systems thinking as we practice in organizations in the workplace is actually just an extension of that kind of logical utilitarian giant network, giant system structure of machine thinking, really. So when the FE lecturers introduced me to this thing called the ethics of care, I was really amazed by it. There's a whole body of literature, and it came out really, it's a very new school of ethics. I mean, if utilitarian ethics came out in the sort of, from 17th century onwards, ethics of care started to be formulated about 1980 by a woman called Carol Gilligan, when her lecturer who was, her professor who was supervising her was looking at moral development. And he had this, Lawrence Kohlbeck had this model of stages of human development, which we all apparently progress through. And what he found was that each stage of moral development, men were more morally advanced than women. And Carol Gilligan was saying, I'm not having any of that. There must be a problem with the model. And of course, what she found was the model was based on a whole series of sort of masculine qualities like drive and reason and rationality and competition, and seemed to exclude some arguably more feminine aspects like care and like imagination and like love. So what he found was, what Gilligan found was that Kohlberg's method actually favoured men in the way it was constructed around a set of male, essentially, gender characteristics. And she started to explore what a more feminine ethics of care might look like. How might that structure? And there is lots of stuff out there. It's been evolving very, very rapidly in the 40 years that it's being developed. But I'm going to pick on one particular framework by a woman called Joan Tronto, who wrote a book that is absolutely seminal, I think. Well, an essay, actually, here. Who Cares? How to Reshape Democratic Politics. And Joan Tronto started to think really deeply about what does it mean to care. And the first thing that she talked about, and again, if we're looking at talking about mentally healthy workplaces, I think these ethics of care can really start to help us think differently. The first thing that she started to talk about was paying attention to what we attend to. So this notion of attentiveness. What is it we're noticing? What is it we're seeing in the world? What is it that we care about? Now, I care about lots of things. I care about the melting ice caps. I care about the situation in Yemen. I care, there's a lot of stuff that I'm aware about that catches my attention and that I can be attentive to. And there's a whole bunch of stuff that I don't see either, or that I don't hear either, because I have blind spots. I have scotomas. I'm just not capable of seeing them. I can't see infrared light. I can't hear sound above a certain wavelength. Doesn't mean it's not there, doesn't mean it doesn't need paying attention to, but unless I really think about what I've got blind spots about, there's stuff that I can miss on this attentiveness phase. What is it that you care about? And again, in business, often it looks like it cares primarily about profitability and externalizing costs. And the reason we have 40% nurses off with stress was because we weren't really worried about having 40% of our nurses off with stress, I guess. The next thing that Tronto talked about after attentiveness was responsibility. Of all the things that I care about in the world, what am I going to choose to care for? What is it uniquely in the world that I can express care for? And this is really about focusing. It's about targeting. It's about choosing what it is that we can make a difference to in the world and picking up our responsibility for that. And again, I would argue that the responsibilities for the mental welfare of our clinical workforce in the health service in England has really not been picked up. There's been a lot of hand-wringing about it. We've got a lot of mindfulness techniques, a lot of wobble rooms, a lot of 10-minute pauses, a lot of ways of dealing with the problem. But as my friend says, in a war, you need field hospitals, but best not be in a war, really. So whose responsibility is it to sue for peace, I suppose? Next thing she talked about was competence. If we choose to care for something, do we have the knowledge and skills that we need? I think that we're fundamentally lacking in knowledge and skills around exploring our ethical frameworks and how they're playing out in the world. And then fourth part of Joan Tronto's model, she talked about responsiveness. And this is deeply rooted in a suspicion of rationality. So we cannot calculate how to deliver care and get the results we want with any certainty. Therefore, we must experiment with what care looks and feels like and then go back and check. How was our care received? What else is demanded of us? What else is emerging as we get into this caring relationship and caring process? So very much caring as emerging process rather than as plan that is implemented. So a very different way of thinking about our relationship to the process of work, the process of health, the process of human being and becoming. And then later on, she added a fifth element into this, which was it really pulled out stuff about the uncertainty of all of this, the plurality of all of this. It's not was the care good or was the care bad? It was in what ways was this care good? In what ways could it be made better? In what ways did we fail to care properly? Communication, trust and respect and notions of solidarity become really important when we talk about the ethics of care. You know, care is a collective process and it's a two-way process. We need to get past the dyad of a caregiver and a care receiver and recognize that care flows quite beautifully in relationship when we get it right. And more importantly, who are we caring with? You know, care is not a solo sport. Care is a team sport. So this very different ethics, which doesn't reject rationality, but it certainly puts it in a supporting role to being able to do what is right and what is right in the moment and what is just in the moment, what is caring in the moment, relegating the logic to support the delivery of care, or I would say the delivery of love, actually, the creation of love. I think this is what we're talking about. How do we manufacture love and what do we manufacture love for? And then how do we put rationality in the service of that? And once I started looking at the ethics of care, I saw more and more clearly that utilitarianism was driving out care. And then we were trying to put it back in, you know, into situations where it had essentially been squeezed out. This said, actually, let's start with care and then let's use rationality to see how we can start to make that work and make that practical in an emerging sense in a changing world. So the ethics of care, if we contrast it to utilitarian ethics, deontological ethics or virtue ethics, it gives us an entirely different way of thinking about our decision making about what's right here, what's right now, what's right in the present. And honestly, thinking less about how do we shape the future and how do we act right here and now. I think we're going to be putting you into breakout groups very shortly. And I've got a question or a series of questions that I'd like you to kind of explore. When you do go into breakout rooms, if you remember to put your cameras on and unmute, otherwise you'll have a very stilted experience in there. One of the things that Joan Tronto said that really stuck with me and I use in a very practical sense is this phrase that says, care is always present, always present. It's seldom seen. It's seldom addressed in the room. Sometimes it's the elephant in the room. Sometimes it's the beautiful chimera in the room. It's seldom seen. And it is always demanding something of us. It's always demanding something of us. So what I want you to just spend a bit of time talking about in the breakout rooms, and I think you'll have about 10 minutes. We'll pull you back, a bit longer, actually. I think we're going to pull you back at about 10 past 12. So you'll have, a good 15 minutes probably in there. If care is the most important quality that you want to express, what does that demand of you right now in that breakout room? Of those ethical qualities that I just ran you through, you know, attentiveness, responsibility, competence, responsiveness, and then this messy sort of binary solidarity piece, which of those ethical qualities might help or hinder your ability to create caring workplaces? You know, is it competence? Is it a lack of attention? Is it attending too much to profit and sweating the assets and not enough to caring for the assets, where the assets are often people? You know, what are the ethical qualities are getting in the way of that expression of care? You know, and again, I would encourage you to think about caring for people, caring for planet, caring for profit. I've got no problem with caring for profit, but how do we put that in a broader context? And then the final thing I want to explore, well, what might change? Now, the utilitarian would think about what might change in the future or what might change out there in the world. I think the care ethicist thinks about what might change in me, what might change in my relationship. So take with you those thoughts. You might want to take a little screenshot of the question for when you get into the breakout rooms. Care is always present, seldom seen, but always demands something of us. What does care demand of you right now in the present? which ethical qualities might be helping or hindering, and what might change? So, Angus, I'll pick up then. While we wait for Amy to arrive or appear from whichever weird part of the universe she's been sent to, either use the chat facility or just, you know, raise your hand. If there's anything you want to sort of feedback that you talked about that felt particularly either interesting or powerful or relevant.
Hi, I think it was it you, Carlene, that said, if you can't look after others if you can't look after yourself. Certainly that's what came out of our chat room, I think. And the way that businesses have changed, whereas before it was like a family and you knew about people, you worried about them, you shared in their ups and downs, and suddenly these big corporate businesses really don't want to care about you. They just want to make money.
So Carol, I agree. Self-care is critical, and it's also impossible. When the care ethicists talk very much about interdependence, your care, Carol, depends on the environment that you are embedded in, the way you are cared for, your ability to give care. So this notion of self-care, you know, rugged individuals looking after themselves and being able to engage back in society and being resilient and tough, is part of the utilitarian kind of myth, I would say. So I think, you know, when people talk about, oh, start with self-care, I think the ethic of care takes me to a more nuanced position that says I can only care for myself in a world that cares. So how do I get myself in a world that cares? And if I'm in a world where the only thing that's cared for is profitability, financial return, share price, I need to recognize that's the nature of the world and decide whether I want to spend my life there. And I think that's quite a tough one, but I think we need to be careful with the narrative of self-care, because for me, it's not far off gaslighting. You know, and when we've got 40% of nurses off with stress, to imply that they need to be taking better care of themselves, frankly, is an insult. You know, they need to be cared for, and not just by their managers and by their employers, but by society as a whole. You know, and we got that briefly, didn't we, during early parts of lockdown, where we were clapping for nurses, clapping for Tesco shelf stackers. We were caring for people that were caring for us. So I think, yeah, the self-care thing is interesting for me. Drew, you seem to be waving particularly vigorously.
Well, hi there. Yes, just a point that I'd make for motivation. It is care within organizations, from my own observation, is effectively part of culture. And a lot depends on the leadership at the top. And one of the things we talked about, how in one organization there can be demonstrably massive amounts of care and another zero care. But a lot emanates from the top and the leadership. And I think part of the problem, as I observe it, is because care is part of culture. Culture is part of the soft skills. And in general terms, and we are leadership organizations for CEOs, basically. And what they don't struggle with the hard stuff. They don't struggle with, you know, financial analysis and cash flows or how to sell and how to market. The biggest potential for their personal and professional development lies with the soft skills, which includes culture and care. Mm. And so I guess all I'm really saying is the degree of success in developing a caring organization, there's a strong correlation between where the leaders are in terms of their own personal development and their own understanding of ethics and care.
So again, Drew, the way that the ethics of care would lead me into that is to say, well, actually, you know, in those organizations where seemingly the people at the top don't care about their staff, well, they do care about something. So what is it that they're caring for? What is it that they're attending to? And it's probably profitability, sales, all those hard datary things, all those utilitarian things. What is their responsibility? So that's the second phase. What is their, do they have responsibility for their staff?
I think in the world as it is and the way the world is going, let's say the new world post-pandemic, if we ever get out of it, then I think care is very much an integral part of that. because I think we're talking about conscious leadership, being not only self-aware, but aware of people around you, your colleagues, your employees, and beyond that, aware of the community and aware globally of climate and effect of that. So we're looking at demand and terms of responsibilities have changed dramatically from simply increasing shareholders' funds and how big the bonus is going to be and how big the house and the car are going to be. I have difficult conversations because we are a community interest company. So we are not for profit. Yeah. We're not about enhancing shareholders' funds. Any surplus goes to a mental health charity. And the point I'm making is, if I'm speaking to a traditional CEO, we're not talking the same language because he's looking at earnings per share, profit, sales, bottom line, full stop. But my point is, all of that is changing. It's changing very dramatically.
I think so.
The CEO thinking in terms of how I've expressed it is not going to have a long lifespan in the future.
I think so. And what we attend to is shifting. The responsibilities we pick up are shifting, becoming more environmentally aware, more caring for staff, more caring. Competence was then the third level. Have we got the knowledge and skills to fulfill these new responsibilities? And you talked a lot about hard and soft skills early on. You know, have we got the right skills and how do we develop them in the boardroom? And then, you know, the last bit for me, how do we develop solidarity? How do we develop trust to have real conversations about what is being cared for and why? And, you know, that again to me feels like a fundamentally sort of critical part of this conversation. What is it that we care for? You know, community interest companies care for, sometimes profit-taking businesses also can care for the right things. But let's have a conversation about what it is we're caring for and how we're caring for it.
If I could just interrupt, there's been quite a few comments there about a lack of time. And the breakout room I was in, Nicole, you work in the NHS and you described really being spread very thinly throughout the day. But have you got anything to add here about the, you know, allowing time and having it as a, if you like, care as a strategic priority? Are you there, Nicole? If you want to unmute. Maybe we've lost her.
I mean, Angus, I'll...
There she is. You just need to unmute, Nicole.
Hi.
There we
go. Apologies, I lost...
Technology, don't you love it?
Missed everything that you said there. I just heard my name, Nicole, and then I went into the abyss.
I'll just say a little bit about care as a strategic priority, Angus. Strategic priorities are deeply rooted in the utilitarian perspective. We will do this because it will deliver us a result at some point in the future. It's an act of rationality and reason, which doesn't mean that necessarily it's a bad thing, but it's rooted in utilitarianism, our habitual pattern of thought. If we are doing care because there is a moral imperative to care for staff, to care for humanity, whether or not that leads to profitability, so it becomes an act of faith rather than an act of reason, then care isn't a strategic priority, it's a human priority. And I know for those of you who work in the NHS in England, Helen Bevan, who is the director of transformation, is always tweeting evidence on what works and what doesn't work. And she put out a tweet the other day saying that respect has been proven to be a valuable commodity in health organizations. So you should respect your staff because it leads to better patient care. Mm-hmm. Now, what if it led to worse patient care? Would that legitimize us being disrespectful to staff? Would that, you know, the utilitarian perspective only measures anything in terms of its impact at some point in the future. Whereas the care ethic says, what is the right thing for me to do here and now? Not quite regardless of consequences, but certainly recognizing that we don't really know what the consequences will be. Now, I was working with some nurses, 400 nurses in a big Zoom conference, and we had a bit more time to unpack this. And at the end of it, they were talking about, you know, becoming a love machine, primarily producing love as their core purpose and all this sort of stuff, you know, and if we just cared in the moment, if we just cared as much as we could in the moment, and then had difficult discussions about, well, if I care a bit more for that patient, does that mean that this patient gets neglected? Or, you know, how do we make all that work? They were so fired up that they believed this could work. But then they said, how do we sell this to the board? How do we sell this to the board? You know, and of course, the board was speaking a utilitarian language. Bring us the evidence. Show us it works. Prove. Now, you know, if we need to start using utilitarian perspective to prove that love works, by golly, what kind of humanity have we become? Mm. And I would say fundamentally, it's the, you know, the utilitarian ethic, which says show that it works, that has led to us losing humanity and care in the workplace. And I would argue has then led to so much mental trauma because we are not able to be the good human beings that essentially we know we are. We have to subjugate our goodness as human beings to some greater motive like profitability or efficiency or utilitarianism. So I think there's something quite key. As soon as we start talking about strategic objectives, we become utilitarian and we lose this glimpse of just caring now.
Yeah, there's a note there from Gemma. You've written, we talked about maintaining a bond of loyalty amongst staff. And what happens when management looks at working from the bottom up, not the top down? Try asking, what do you need for a good day of work? What does that look like? Gemma, do you want to say a bit more?
So it was actually Paul, was it Paul Burr, who was discussing how that had worked within his experience. So he might be more qualified to speak about that. So I'll hand over to him.
Thanks very much. I was just making a point that In my experience, I've run businesses. I've had quite a lot of staff working for me, and I've always found that the best way of you want your profits to be high, of course you do, and the best way to achieve that really is to look after your staff, because in anything you do, if you look after your staff, they will look after your customers. I've done social enterprise for about 10 years, and I've noticed that because the system is set up in many ways that it's a top-down structure almost, to try to get from bottom up, to get to bottom up is really, really hard. You've almost got to say, keep doing what you're doing, but in the meantime, we're all going to work over here and do bottom up, because you can't really stop the top-down stuff. It does so much. It has an impact on everything. Mm. So you can't really go to it and say, I want you to change. Because change is a really, really difficult thing for a big structure to do. So you almost have to have a space where you can operate that's outside of that without the same rules and target the individual need, I think, and be there where the action is. I don't know if that makes sense to you, but it's a very different way of doing things, I think. Mm-hmm. It worked for me, I think.
Whether it's bottom up, top down, I mean, you're certainly right. I've had some success going into boardrooms and really helping them, coach them towards thinking through, are we working from a utilitarian ethic here? Are we really trying to be strategic and believing we can shape the future? Or are we in this moment right now just trying to care for what matters most? And what is it we're caring for? Are we caring for profits? Are we caring for some weird metrics that stand as a ridiculous proxy for care in most health service organizations? Or are we fundamentally caring about the people that we are paid to care for? And I think it's just trying to catch people, you know, slipping back into utilitarianism or virtue ethic or rule-based ethics and really pulling them back to saying, is this the best care we can offer now? And what do we learn from that? So it's almost bringing this humility in, particularly to the boardroom, because the boardrooms love their 5-year plans and their 10-year plans, and they know that they're nonsense. They know that they're nonsense, but they're their nonsense.
So I think we're going to have to go with that. Stop there, actually. I'm just very aware of time.
Well, I'd just like to say a huge, huge thank you to Mike. I'm very aware that we have totally skimmed the iceberg, the top of the iceberg there. What a massive, massive subject it is. And I am really, really stimulating. There's so much more to dig into here. You know, it's huge. So do open these conversations, you know, with your colleagues and so on. Do stay in touch with Mike. There are his details there. A huge thank you, Mike. Really stimulating, really fascinating. So thank you very much for your time today.
Pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Good. And if you like what we do, please follow us on LinkedIn. You will see events there and so on and so forth. We're also going to be sending some information out to you as a follow-on from this. There is a surprise in that, so please open the email and see what that surprise offer is. As Amy mentioned, we work proactively with all levels of organisations, big and small, private and public, and if we can help you, please get in touch. We'd love to work with you. Next week, we've got Jeff McDonald. Jeff was Vice President of Human Resources for Unilever globally. He had a huge job. He is now an international campaigner for mental health. It promises to be a cracker. He's very charismatic, great speaker. And he's going to be talking on the importance of making mental health a strategic priority. So hopefully we'll see you all there. And again, thank you very much, everybody. It's been a real pleasure seeing you all here.
Yes, thank you very much, everyone.